Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses the significance of Hugo Chavez's re-election victory in Venezuela's October 7th presidential vote. Cindy Corey, mother of peace activist Rachel Corey, killed by an Israeli bulldozer in 2003, who discusses her family's struggle for justice in Rachel's case and their promotion of human rights in Palestine and around the world. And former Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson, who talks about his Justice Party presidential campaign that's targeting plutocracy and corruption. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Until a sudden military coup in March, Mali was viewed by many nations as a model for democratic elections and a vibrant civil society. Now the West African country's weak civilian government is beset by an ambitious military and Al-Qaeda-linked Islamicists who control much of Mali's rural areas that are on the brink of famine. Islamic fighters have transformed northern Mali into a harsh Sharia state, have destroyed ancient religious sites, and amputated the hands of criminals. The United Nations Security Council is now debating a resolution that would authorize a regional military intervention to oust the Islamicists from northern Mali. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is preparing to deploy a force of 3,000 soldiers into Mali over the coming months. The Security Council, the African Union, and ECOWAS will meet in Mali to review intervention plans on October 19th. Meanwhile, humanitarian groups are warning that military intervention in Mali could complicate the urgent work of bringing massive food aid to 18 million people near starvation who live in the Sahel region from Senegal to Chad and Sudan. According to Reuters, the current Mali crisis is amplified by infighting between the central government and sectors inside the army who are questioning the civilian leaders' request for outside military intervention. The high-profile international campaign against human trafficking, where girls are forced into prostitution, is increasingly becoming an American issue. Hollywood celebrities Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore recently launched the Real Men Don't Buy Girls campaign, complete with slick social media appeals, with the goal of raising awareness about child sex slavery in the U.S. The celebrity-driven campaign claims that between 1 and 300,000 children are trafficked annually in the U.S. for sex. But those numbers, taken from a University of Pennsylvania study, have been found to be a gross exaggeration. The U.S. government estimates sex trafficking victims to be in the tens of thousands, but even those numbers have been criticized as unfounded and far too high. Critics say the celebrity-driven campaign and its supporters, such as New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, distort the issue and divert funds from tracking cases of forced labor and kidnapping experienced by domestic and farm workers in the U.S. Some critics charge that the campaign against trafficking appears to have more in common with a middle-class moral crusade against prostitution. Trafficking, narrowly defined, involves girls and women who are enslaved and transported to another country to work in a brothel. The U.S. law on trafficking is much broader, asserting that all minors induced by force, fraud, or coercion to be involved in a commercial sex act shall be treated by the government as a victim of human trafficking. In August, the airwaves in New Mexico were filled with attack ads from outside groups, including super PACs attempting to influence voters in the state's tight U.S. Senate race. But the ad buys by conservative groups, including Americans for Prosperity, founded by the billionaire Koch brothers and Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS, may have backfired. Democratic candidate Martin Heinrich has built up a 10-point lead over his Republican rival, Heather Wilson, in a race to replace outgoing Democratic Senator Jeff Bingaman. In a review of media ad buys in August, ProPublica reports that outside groups, who do not legally have to disclose their donors, outspent the Senate campaigns of both Heinrich and Wilson. The right-wing groups spent $658,000 in ads attacking Heinrich, a sitting congressman, for supporting the Obama administration's stimulus package. During the same month, the Republican candidate spent $512,000 on ads. Meanwhile, a million-dollar TV ad campaign sponsored by a coalition of environmental groups has been credited with bumping up Heinrich's poll margin over Wilson. With the race now trending toward Heinrich, a campaign reformer who supports more disclosure of political donations made to independent groups and PACs, the Republican Senate Campaign Committee has announced it's pulling its ads out of the New Mexico race. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez was re-elected to a fourth six-year term in office in an October 7th contest closely watched around the world. Chavez, who has been battling cancer over the past year, won the vote by 11%, his smallest margin of victory since he first ran for office in 1998. He'd won his previous election by a margin of 26% in 2006. The 58-year-old president faced down his strongest opponent to date, Enrique Capriles Radonsky, the young and energetic conservative governor of Miranda State. In his victory speech, Chavez talked about his goal to deepen his 21st-century Bolivarian socialist revolution over the next 6 years. Many observers attribute Chavez's election win to his transformation of the Venezuelan economy, funding major programs designed to help the Latin American nation's poor majority to lift themselves out of poverty, programs largely made possible by his redistribution of profits from Venezuela's nationalized oil company. Since Chavez took office in 1999, extreme poverty has declined from nearly 25% to 8.6% in 2011. Unemployment has been cut in half, and GDP per capita has more than doubled. While Washington and much of the West corporate media depict Chavez as a caudillo or dictator, most international election observers who have monitored Venezuela's recent votes have judged the results to have been clean and transparent. Your reporter spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses the significance of Hugo Chavez's re-election as president for the people of oil-rich Venezuela and progressive movements across Latin America.
There's been a huge change in South America and some other parts of Latin America as well in the last decade and a half. And so you've had left governments elected in Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela and Ecuador and Bolivia and Uruguay, and all of them keep getting reelected. Some of them have been reelected twice, or in Chavez's case, more than twice. So this is because they've really changed things there. I mean, poverty has dropped a lot in the last decade. You know, in Venezuela, it was, since the government got control over oil, it's down by 50%, and extreme poverty has declined by 70%, and they'll probably get rid of the rest of it this year with this new program that they have, pay $100 a month to families for every child. And so there's been a lot of big changes in all these countries, and I think that's the best way to see the election in Venezuela. It's pretty much the same phenomenon that you see in all of these countries, which where left governments came in and changed policies significantly from the terrible economic disaster that they had from 1980 to 2000.
Well, Mark, before we let you go, I just wanted to ask you about what's the effect of Chavez's victory on the rest of the left electoral movements across Latin America? How does that bolster in terms of the generous deals that Venezuela gives its political allies across Latin America on oil?
Well, it's not just the oil, but, I mean, Venezuela gives an equivalent of about $7 billion a year in aid to other countries in Latin America. And so that's big, especially for the Caribbean countries, for Nicaragua, for smaller countries. The oil deals even go to the Dominican Republic, where they can't discount the oil, but they can sell it on low interest or almost zero interest, really, terms for loans. So Venezuela has played an important role. But the other governments, Brazil and Argentina, the other left governments, they also see Venezuela as a very important strategic ally. And this election was extremely important to all of them. and not just to the smaller or the more left governments that you see being trashed in the Washington Post, but also to Brazil, who's a very close ally of Venezuela, because these countries have really changed the whole region. They have a whole different agenda of regional economic integration, independent foreign policy from the United States, they all work together. I mean, they've even created an alternative to the Organization of American States now, which has everybody in it except for the U.S. and Canada, because they were tired of the U.S. Dominating that organization, especially after the 2009 military coup in Honduras, where the United States played a major role in helping that coup succeed against the wishes of all the South American governments. So this is the thing that's going on, and Venezuela is not the leader of this, as maybe some of the right wing would like to say, but it's a very important part of it. And they're sitting on the largest oil reserves in the whole world, which is going to make them always a very influential country, and one, of course, that has a government that the United States has tried to get rid of for the past decade. So it's very important to all the left-of-center governments in the whole region and to a big part of the world. I mean, Russia, China, everybody's watching, was watching this election.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org to find more news and commentary on Hugo Chavez's re-election and Venezuelan politics. Rachel Corey, a 23-year-old student from Olympia, Washington, was crushed to death by a bulldozer on March 16, 2003, as she stood in nonviolent civil disobedience with activists from the International Solidarity Movement, wearing a neon vest, trying to protect a Palestinian family's home in the Gaza Strip against demolition. In late August, an Israeli judge ruled that Israel's military was not responsible for Corey's death. Her family had brought a civil suit seeking a symbolic $1 in damages and legal expenses after no action was taken against the military driver of the bulldozer by the Israeli government. The family had previously lost a civil suit in U.S. courts against Caterpillar, the manufacturer of the specially equipped bulldozer. The memory of Rachel Corey and her courageous activism is revered around the world. Her parents, Craig and Cindy Corey, addressed hundreds of people who gathered on October 6th and 7th in New York City for the 4th Bertrand Russell Tribunal on Palestine. At the tribunal, the Coreys announced they were flying to Reykjavik, Iceland on October 7th to accept the Ono Lenin Peace Prize on Rachel's behalf. She was one of five winners of the prize that included John Perkins, Lady Gaga, the late Christopher Hitchens, and the Russian punk music group Pussy Riot. The prize money will go to the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice, founded by her family after her death. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rachel's mother, Cindy Corey, just before she addressed the New York Tribunal. Here she discusses her family's ongoing efforts for justice in Rachel's case, as well as their promotion of human rights in Palestine and around the world.
In terms of gaining accountability and really truth about what happened to Rachel and justice, ultimately, we filed a civil lawsuit in Israel. That was because the position of the U.S. government was that the investigation into what happened to her by the Israeli military was not thorough, credible, and transparent. But the U.S. was not taking further position, said that they couldn't. So we felt we needed to take that step. It's been a very long process. We're starting into our 10th year of dealing with this, and with the lawsuit in Israel, oral testimony began in 2010 in March. It ended in July 2011, and we've just had the verdict in the case. It was in Haifa District Court, and on the 28th of August, we were in court. Judge Oded Gershon gave the verdict. There's only one judge, there's not a jury. And he found against us. He found that what happened to Rachel was an act occurring during war. And according to that, he stated that the military was therefore not responsible for what happened. Those aren't the legal words, but that's the gist of it. And of course, that's very concerning because it impacts all civilians whenever there's a conflict taking place there. He had other things to say. He thought the investigation was made entirely appropriately, and we definitely disagree with his judgment on that. Also, that the military behaved completely well on the day that Rachel was killed, and we have a lot of concerns about that as well. So that was the outcome. I think from our family's perspective, the decision was such a bad one and it's such a disappointing one. It was an upsetting day for us, of course, but not totally unexpected. But I think it's provided another window into what's happening with institutions inside Israel. This is one judge. I don't know what might have happened before another. But I know that Israeli human rights organizations have raised a lot of concerns about the courts and how the courts also stand with the military and that it contributes actually to the impunity that the military enjoys. And we still feel that there was a promise made from the Israeli government, from Ariel Sharon, to President Bush, that there would be a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation into the case. And that's a diplomatic promise that has yet to be fulfilled. We have met with high-level officials in the U.S. government at the embassy and so forth. And we have some assurance that the U.S. will be looking at this decision. And I think our expectation is that that has to happen in the same way that human rights organizations are looking at these decisions and how the courts function there. I think it also has to happen here in the U.S. because we're, of course, providing the funding for so much of this to continue.
When you said the judge ruled that because it was an incident that happened during war, that was 2003, March of 2003. I'm not aware that Israel, did they just put everything under a state of war? Because I didn't think there was actually necessarily a state of war at the time.
I can't speak for the Israeli military and how and Israeli state's attorneys and how they try to characterize what was happening there. But I think there are very real questions about whether you can actually have a state of war with a people that you're occupying, the West Bank and Gaza. One thing that happened with this lawsuit that I will add is that for a while it was stopped because there was a law passed in the Knesset that said if something happened in an area of conflict, that nobody could bring a lawsuit from anything that happened there. And they could determine where the area of conflict was, whether it was, and of course it would be the West Bank and Gaza, probably East Jerusalem, but it could be off anywhere. And that decision was eventually overturned, or pieces of it, by the Israeli Supreme Court, which is what allowed our case to move forward. So these are the kinds of legal questions that are involved. But I think the bottom line is that we all have to be concerned about is that if we allow the rights of civilians, whether they're protesters or they're civilians in homes during times of conflict, to be completely disregarded, those are our rights that will be lost as well. And any of us who find ourselves in situations like that will be under the same threats. I think that the decision creates a situation of impunity for the military that is ultimately very damaging for military, for the young people that I've seen in Israel who are wearing the uniforms and carrying the guns. I don't think it's helpful to them.
So how would you describe Rachel's legacy in specifically in Gaza or among the Palestinians?
It's the love, really, that our family feels from Palestinians is very moving to us. In the beginning, it took me a while to really understand how much it meant to Palestinians worldwide that she had gone there, that she had taken the stand that she did, and that her life was taken from her as a result of that. People would come up to me and they would burst into tears, and they could hardly speak. And so gradually I came to understand how intensely this is felt. For our family, it means that we've been embraced by the Palestinian people and really by all people who support human rights for people everywhere.
That was Cindy Corey, mother of Rachel Corey, killed by an Israeli bulldozer in March 2003. Find links to the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Rocky Anderson, the former two-term mayor of Salt Lake City and a 1996 Democratic nominee in Utah's 2nd Congressional District, publicly broke with the Democratic Party in August 2011. In an angry letter of resignation sent to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Anderson wrote, quote, "The Constitution has been eviscerated while Democrats have stood by with nary a whimper. It is a gutless and unprincipled party, bought and paid for by the same interests that buy and pay for the Republican Party." In January 2012, Anderson accepted the presidential nomination of the Justice Party, a new political party he helped found. His running mate, Luis Rodriguez, is a leading Chicano writer and activist. Now, Anderson, a 61-year-old attorney, is campaigning for the White House with the goal of focusing the public's attention on what he sees as the serious failings of the nation's two major political parties. Rocky Anderson will be on the ballot in 15 states this November. Anderson, who is the winner of awards for his leadership on human rights, defense of the U.S. Constitution, and environmental stewardship, advocates positions favoring a single-payer health care system, policies to address climate change, a constitutional amendment to revoke corporate personhood, and an end to U.S. military intervention abroad. Your reporter spoke with Rocky Anderson about his Justice Party presidential campaign that's targeting plutocracy and corruption.
There were a number of us that really felt that we needed a new party, and not just another political party that's going to come around each election, put up candidates, run the elections, and then disappear until the next time around. And we see that with most third parties in this country. This party was started with the intention of creating a broad-based movement, because most social progress in this country has resulted not from electing the right people, but from those at the grassroots getting together, organizing, mobilizing, and forcing the change. We, the people in this country, are really the leaders when we'll rise to the occasion. It's not those that we elect to office by and large. So we really do intend to keep this up tenaciously, and we invite people from all parties. You don't have to give up your party affiliation. If you agree with us on our major issues, come join in the fight. Come join the movement, because this is not about partisan politics. It's about the public interest. And the major areas we're addressing are, number one, the evisceration of our Constitution. What's been done to due process, the rule of law, the restrictions that are supposed to be there under the War Power Clause of the Constitution. And we have presidents now, the last two, Bush and Obama, who seem to think they can just make the decision as tyrants and commit this country to war without even asking leave of Congress. If Congress had lived up to its constitutional responsibility, we never would have invaded and occupied Iraq and started this ongoing tragedy. And then, of course, the imperial presidency, the president taking upon himself the dictatorial powers to target United States citizens for assassination. And three of them so far have been killed. One of them, a 16-year-old boy in Yemen. No due process there. Due process clause says before our government can take anybody's life, liberty, or property, especially a United States citizen, they're entitled to due process. And this president, who's supposedly a lawyer and a constitutional law professor, seems to have forgotten about the due process clause. This is a very dangerous time in our nation's history. And then, of course, we've got the dictatorship of the corrupting influence of money in our system. We really don't have anything approaching a democracy. We have a plutocracy, where our government is up for sale to the highest bidders. And once again, it's almost always at the expense of the vast majority of Americans when these corporate interests or other sources of concentrated wealth have their way with our Congress and our president. I mean, do we think that President Obama woke up one day and said, hey, it would really be great in the public interest if I go out and veto the efforts of the EPA to reduce ozone levels in cities around the country? Of course, it had nothing to do with public interest. It had everything to do with the money flowing from polluting industries. Why has he broken all of his promises about providing leadership on climate change? Because of the power of the money in the fossil fuel industry. Why do we have the most abysmal health care system, even and especially under Obamacare? I'd call it Obamacare and Romneycare, both, because they're virtually the same. Why do we have that kind of a system? We're unique in the entire industrialized world in not providing health care for everybody, and we're paying twice as much as the average in the industrialized world, and we're getting far worse medical outcomes. Why is that? We know that it's the millions upon millions of dollars spent by the for-profit insurance and pharmaceutical industries.
Rocky, there are many people out there who are going to vote on what they say is the lesser evils of the two major party candidates. And there are a lot of folks out there, while they may be sympathetic with your positions on many issues, the Green Party candidate Jill Stein and others, they feel that the system is rigged against a third party so that your chances of winning are almost nil, so they don't want to throw away their vote. How would you convince a voter who's convinced of those facts to vote otherwise, to vote their conscience rather than their fears?
Well, first of all, you're certainly not throwing away a vote to vote for somebody that you believe in, to stand up for principle, instead of holding your nose and voting for somebody that you don't agree with. Let your voice be heard. Imagine the impact if everybody would just get over this fear and vote for who they really believe in and for those principles. What an amazing beginning that would be for this Democratic movement. There have been third-party candidates who had strong showings. Ross Perot, Teddy Roosevelt when he ran with the Progressive Party, which a lot of people now call the Bull Moose Party. They actually won those elections in important respects because they got so much support and they were so persuasive to the American people that what they were fighting for ended up in large part being implemented into law. If they hadn't been part of those campaigns, if they hadn't been getting the word out, if they hadn't had the kind of support they did, it's doubtful that the kinds of things they were talking about ever would have been implemented.
That was former Salt Lake City Mayor and Justice Party presidential candidate Rocky Anderson. Learn more about his campaign and other independent political parties running for the White House this year by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.